say, no, no, I think the New Green Deal, or whatever the hell they call it. The Green New Deal, right? Green New Deal. I encourage it. I think it's really something that they should promote. They should work hard on. It's something our country needs. Desperately, they have to go out and get it. But I'll take the other side of that argument only because I'm mandated to. I'm mandated. But they should stay with that argument. Never change. No planes. No energy. When the wind stops blowing, that's the end of your life. Let's go. Harold, is the wind blowing today? I'd like to watch something.
That was insult comic Donald Trump performing a legendary two-hour set at the annual Conservative Political Action Conference just outside of Washington, D.C. on Saturday. Hello, everyone. Happy Big New Green Monday, and welcome to the Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason podcast. I am Matt Welch, along with my Reason super friends, Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hello, non-conservatives.
Hello.
Hello, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Nick, you were in that room at that time and wrote a piece under the headline.
I'm pretty sure part of me is still there, Matt. Not all of me came back.
You were having your fentanyl laced with marijuana or vice versa. You wrote a piece.
The Skittles party. It was the whole weekend. It was just a big, long Skittles party the reporters pooled their drugs and put them in a big bowl, and then we would just grab handfuls and chat out.
Disappointingly, it was actually all just Skittles.
Yeah, it was like Kellyanne Conway and Sarah Carter.
Both of these things explain your post, Nick.
Mm-hmm. Which, so it was under the headline, Trump just might have won the 2020 election today, was immediately linked to on Drudge, is setting traffic records even as we speak. So I guess my first question to you, Nick, is given the incentives here, we're pretty much guaranteed that you're going to be on the Trump train for the next 21 months?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm going to be a baggage handler on the Trump train, a red cap. Yeah. No, it's one of the things that is amazing. And obviously, this is something that Trump has done, I think, unlike any other politician in our lifetime, where he makes people insane. And, you know, my piece was about
evidence
it
of
was
that.
A rhetorical. Well, no, but this is, I mean, widely taken as such, but it's anybody who's watching that and cannot appreciate the tour de force that it was like his, the thing that he did when he was announcing his national emergency, where it was a random, you know, basically it was like an upbeat festivist description of grievances, except it was kind of positive and jokey. And of course, there goes the traffic outside of my New York apartment. So I apologize for that. Somebody, a motorcycle gang is just coming to town, it seems.
We can't hear it.
It was brilliant. And in the clip that you played, I mean, he was actually very funny and nasty in a way that I think only he and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez fully inhabit. And, you know, it's not a mistake or an accident that they're from New York, but he was funny. He was smart. He was wide ranging. He was delusional and he was making up stuff, but he was also concerned for people in a way that he rarely showed. And he was kind of sunny. I mean, I think what is most interesting to me is that he's dropping more and more of the American carnage stuff. And it's not that he's not talking about horrible things in the world, but he's pushing that onto the Democrats. He's pushing that onto other people rather than kind of pulling it into himself. And I just don't see anybody, you know, in the Democratic field, real or imagined, who's going to be able to stay on the stage with that. He will be blowing them off. It'll be like Matt, what not Bose, was it ADM or what was the old ad for the speakers where the guy is sitting in the chair,
right,
and his hair and his
Playboy
clothes
ad.
Are being
I think it was Bose.
Blown off him. Yeah, or whatever. I mean, it's just like if he can maintain this, and you know, that's a
it was
big
from
if
Max because Zell it might have. Remember when people
Thank
bought
you,
tapes?
Sell.
We've actually erased that. Like you used to have to erase a tape from our memories because, and there that's why we couldn't remember who the brand was.
Thank you.
Well,
I would just
appreciate that. Tapes.
I would just point out that I think sometime in 2016, it was soon after Ted Cruz made his New York Values speech, I wrote a prescient, damn it, column saying that he was wrong about which New York values are bad. He was kind of referring to the gays, I think, or something. But that he's absolutely right that we have way too many New York values represented in national politics and the presidential candidates. And I couldn't be more right about that on every passing day, as we have like 70,000 New Yorkers all competing for the presidency. Catherine, I was taking CPAC the way it should be, which is by not being there and being very far away. But I can see that the favorite theme there, besides Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Alexandria Cortez, blah, 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 over and over again, was something to do with about how they're all going to come for your hamburgers, and
which in any normal CPAC, Seb Gorka saying, you know, this was what Stalin wanted. Even Stalin did, you know, wasn't able to get your hamburgers, but the Green New Deal will. That would have been the takeaway line from CPAC.
It's clear that the Republican Party and the people who vote for it are absolutely giddy with the idea that they're going to run against socialism. So is this a massive own goal from the Democratic side? And just to be clear, that refers, Catherine, to in soccer.
All right. Thank you for the sports ball
a
explainer.
A game that is played with a ball and human feet.
I actually this weekend got 100% shamed by a group of people, all of whom were immigrants except me, who were all able to correctly identify the Washington Capitals logo, which I was not able to do. So that was fair to assume I know nothing. So here's the thing, right? Like, I also am excited to have an election where we just talk about why socialism is bad for a year. Like, that sounds awesome to me. And the fact that all of these people at CPAC are also super stoked about it is crushing my joy. They are taking away from me the one thing I had, which was to be excited about making fun of socialism. And they are turning it into stupid. And so I think, you know, this is like, I was not present in the room during Trump's speech as Nick was. And so I will give him the benefit of the doubt that his read on the situation isn't totally freaking insane, which is what my initial
thank you. That's a really high degree of confidence. That's like what Trump believes about U.S. intelligence services. Or something.
I think that from a libertarian perspective, from my perspective at least, what this election is now about for us is trying to parse the difference between Trump's version of the Democrats' version of socialism, the Democrats' actual version of socialism, and actual socialism, which are three almost unrelated things at this point. And, you know, I am not excited about having another culture war election, which is the thing that Trump wants to do with this socialism fight. I think instead it would be great if we could have a policy election, which in a weird way is what the Democrats want to do with the socialism thing and what I think libertarians should want to do with the socialism thing, too.
Suderman, let's be gracious for a moment, or let you try to be gracious for a moment. The socialism line was the, you know, the greatest line in the State of the Union address on some levels, and you know, all these Republicans.
I said that in our post SOTU podcast.
And jumped to their feet. In what ways can you point to over the last 2 years of Trump administration governance and the reaction of Republican Party since then? In what ways have they governed as if they were genuinely worried about the encroaching wave of socialism?
So if you want to
gracious,
if you want to make a really the best case that I can make is some of their deregulatory measures. And I have long said that I care a lot more about regulation than I do about spending and taxation. And that actually libertarians should probably be spending more effort on regulation. Not that we don't spend a lot, but that we should be spending even more because regulations, spending and taxation, yes, it takes your money. And that's, you know, that in some ways sort of is a cost to your freedom. But regulation is the government outlawing a specific activity. It says, simply says, it's not that there's, you can do this and you have to pay. It's, you can't do this, period. And Trump, Trump's administration has been certainly more deregulatory than the last couple of administrations. I think some of that deregulation has been overstated. In part because some of it started before Trump, you know, sort of doesn't always, it often counts numbers of regulations rather than total cost, that sort of thing. But I don't think there's any real question that Trump has gone after regulations and been more reticent to add new ones, especially big new ones, than certainly than the Obama administration or than a Hillary Clinton administration would have been. But that said, I think Catherine's point is important. When Trump is talking about the evils of socialism, he's often not talking about real socialism, the sort of textbook socialism, as we think of it. And he's also using it in weird ways. And I would sort of particularly point to his argument that when Democrats want to do Medicare for all, which, to be fair, would not simply extend the current Medicare program as we know it to everyone. When Democrats want to do Medicare for all, he argues, well, that's trying to destroy Medicare with socialism. Medicare is a socialist program. It is America's largest government-run healthcare program, and Trump
but
has been making the argument
about
that if we go after if we expand the program, if we do Medicare for all, that is harming seniors by converting Medicare to socialism. It is already a socialist program,
right? But it's a single payer program. It's a government program, and I think he's right to
Medicare
intuit
is
him,
a
Peter.
Single payer program for seniors.
Yes. Right. But I'm saying he's right to intuit that what the Democrats are talking about is, first off, a massive expansion of government, which people don't like, a disruption in the healthcare system, which you rightly point out is the big fear and the problem why it's hard to actually
sure,
fix.
Sure. I mean,
how shitty this is.
One of the strongest
and also,
arguments,
though, you see
most
this,
effective,
but you
I
see
say,
this in
is against
in
Medicare,
AOC,
is that it will Medicare for all is that it will destroy Medicare as we know it. And I think Medicare as we know it is a big problem, but it's also pretty
it should
clear.
Be destroyed. It should be destroyed overnight. But no, but what I'm saying is AOC and people like her and Kamala Harris, when she first spoke, said, yeah, we and you, I mean, you posted this at Reason. There's 100 Democratic co-sponsors of legislation to shut down private health insurance in the country. That's what he's getting at when he says they're socialists. And, you know, it's not, you know, it's not European, you know, it's not early 20th century socialism, but it's, you know, it's a real threat. And I think that is what is going to alienate people from whatever Democrat gets up there. And Bernie Sanders will be saying that. He wants Medicare for all. He doesn't want he doesn't want private health insurance. He doesn't want private health.
Well, it's certainly fair to call Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez socialists or democratic socialists, since that's what they call themselves. I don't have any problem with labeling those folks socialist. What I have a problem with is Trump using that attack line to defend a program that is already socialist and to kind of defend the status quo. And what I see happening here on the right is that Republicans are giddy to spend the next 2 years talking about the evils of socialism and how bad it is and tarring Democrats as socialists. And they're not even really wrong to do so. Democrats are moving to the left, certainly in the presidential campaign, the presidential field. You really see that. At the same time, what they're doing that as a way of defending the awful status quo and not having to put forth ideas of their own.
Catherine, you claimed not to be an immigrant, but we all know that you're a common Romanian. Can you reflect for a moment on what the traditional in like actual capital S socialist countries, what the traditional approach towards, I don't know, international trade, walls and immigration were and are?
Yeah, I mean, the other place where this has come, so obviously the answer is not pro. The other place where this has come up recently, which Nick, maybe you can chime in on this as well, is there's been a little micro controversy about abortion and socialism, kicked off by no one other than the Bulwark's own Molly Jung Fast, which is a sentence.
Jung
Fast, which is a heck of a sentence. Especially in Romania, speaking of, you know, socialist countries are hardly utopian choice-laden options for women. There was a huge amount of, you know, there's a reason that we have the trope of the Romanian orphan, and that is because Romanian women were, it was impossible to get a legal or even, in most cases, a black market abortion. Romanians and also socialists typically want to trade with only other socialists or maybe no one, depending. Also, they don't tend to be great at it due to the lack of prices in their systems, which help people arbitrate between different currencies and different modes of production. It is not like the idea of there being a perfect way to map the American left and the American right onto the Cold War era conflict between capitalism and socialism is unfortunately a false one, and that is not, that's not going to pay off.
And I think we're going to, you know, to go to Peter's point, I think we're going to have a particularly, you know, unless libertarians and unless reason take control of this conversation, we're going to have a long, boring, stupid conversation where you have people on the left kind of rightly pointing out that, oh, you know, we're not Venezuelan here. We're not trying to be like Maduro. We just want more, the government to regulate more and to tax more and to spend more shit and fuck up more, you know, parts of the economy in our everyday life. And then you're going to have Republicans saying anybody who does not support Donald Trump is by definition not even a socialist, but a communist. And I think, you know, we need to speak to this conversation with an understanding that, you know, no, but very few people in America are actually socialist in any meaningful way. There is a question about how much you want to the government to expand or to contract, and that that does not even map very easily onto contemporary Republicans and Democrats. They're not the same thing, but they both are, you know, for, I think from any kind of free market perspective and any kind of embrace of capitalism and individualism and individual rights before the state, they are, you know, they're part of the problem for different reasons, but we need to be staging a clearer conversation about why Medicare for old people doesn't work. Medicare for all would be even more disastrous to everybody. And the same thing goes with many elements of the Green New Deal, but it also goes for the military industrial complex.
Peter, I've been weirdly and renewedly interested in parallels to the 1972 election, in which you had a not very popularly elected incumbent president with a whiff of scandal around him, who was widely seen as kind of crude and a power politician from outside the usual sources of politics, although he'd been in Washington for a long time, too. But anyways, he's up against someone, George McGovern, who is seen as being way left of the pale here. And he stomps his face off in a culture war election by more than 20 percentage points, wins 49 of 50 states. Do you get kind of a vibe of that thing happening now? Do you think Americans are getting a little bit scared of the rising green new whatever coming from the left? And is that giving Trump an opportunity, or are we all just sort of inventing stuff on the fly to convince us of our own priors?
Well, first of all,
can
it's
we pause here for
early.
Left of the pale?
That's
depending on the map,
we all know what that
means. The Western Sea.
This is
that's how language evolves.
Yeah, of no one is confused about what Matt meant there.
Yes, and I would
possibly
point out
Matt, but the rest of us know.
That's an homage to the Replacements. Go on, Peter.
So I think that is one possibility, but it's very early. I think, you know, if you want to look for analogs, it's either 1972 or it's 1980. And it's not clear whether Trump ends up looking more like Carter or more like Nixon. If I had to bet, almost before seeing the 2020 field for Democrats, and obviously that field is still taking shape, if I had to bet, I would say that the most likely outcome for the next election is that Trump wins again, simply because that is a likely outcome. Presuming that he is, you know, not impeached, that he's sort of none of the kind of highly unusual scenarios in which he's removed or steps down from office happen. I think it's more likely than not that Trump wins again, although I wouldn't say that it's extremely likely, just a little bit more likely. And, you know, in some ways, while I find myself frustrated by it, I think there's something to Nick's argument about Trump and the 2020 election, which is that, I mean, if I want to boil down Nick's argument, it's a little more complicated than this, but like, it's basically that Trump is more entertaining than anybody else in the Democratic field. And that's not wrong. And there is a way in which politics, especially presidential politics, has become a kind of has become entertainment for a lot of people and has become a kind of way of self-identifying with a certain team and a certain style rather than sort of a way of thinking about what it means, sort of what our nation means, what it should stand for, and how to fix the problems that we have in the country. And so if the race becomes which candidate is more entertaining, and that is a reasonably likely outcome, then I think Trump wins.
Catherine, there's a kind of a consolidation afoot of support from the Republican Party behind Donald Trump. There's like an actual merger of the Republican National Committee's fundraising and messaging operation with a Trump reelection campaign, which is hasn't really been done in the past. And just on polling, you'll see 60% or some large 40%, let's say, of Republicans say, yeah, I would like there to be a challenger to Trump or, some other kind of party. And then when presented with one, they're like, yeah, no, I don't think so. I want to get your reaction to a single sentence that Rich Lowry wrote. National Review's Rich Lowry, he wrote a thing arguing against that there should be a primary challenger against Trump. I think it's a bad idea. Here's the sentence. There is obviously a character case to be made against Trump, although Republican voters are already aware of his flaws and strongly support him nonetheless. What do you think about that?
I think that's the truest thing about Trump. I think that's also the relevant insight into how the eventual Mueller report will go. I think that is an accurate assessment of the main challenge facing a Republican challenger. This has been, this is a trope now, I think almost a joke even in D.C., where people say to each other, this is it. This is the thing that's going to bring him down. This is the thing where people are going to hear it or see it or learn about it and say, this is too much. This is unpresidential. And different people have different tolerances. So some people believe that that thing will be he paid hush money to have a woman he had an affair with, shut down. Some people think the thing is he had a meeting, his son had a meeting, one of his agents had a meeting with someone in Russia in exactly the right configuration to trip America's Cold War moral triggers. Some people think the thing is he has nothing on the presidential schedule again today. And all those people keep being wrong, and they are going to keep being wrong. And Rich Lowry is right about that. He is not right about the underlying takeaway that he offers, which is like, nah, don't bother. I think that is a misunderstanding of the long game of politics. But I do think he is right. Trump voters like Trump. Trump voters are going to vote for him again. And it really doesn't matter. I mean, there is something, right? There is a limit. There is something somewhere where like video of Donald Trump,
the pee
like
tape.
Peeing on someone while breaking into an office in the Watergate. Maybe.
Come on, they tried that with R. Kelly and it didn't stick.
R. Kelly is, I feel like he's maybe on the downslope now. But yeah, so in general, I think there, of course, are limits to this theory, but Trump has proven remarkably resistant to the thing. Like, literally, I was at a literal Georgetown dinner party on Friday.
Were there cocktails?
There were cocktails. It was both a cocktail party and a Georgetown dinner party. And someone said to me, when the Mueller report comes out, I guarantee you people will have had enough. Fully, yeah. Sincerely, a journalist, a non-right-wing
but,
journalist.
So at the same time, there is a weird strain of pro-Trump or at least kind of quasi-pro-Trump punditry exemplified by the Lowry line that Matt read. That's basically like, well, Trump is deeply awful, but voters don't know that, but voters do know that, and therefore, okay.
Trump is
deeply awful, but because the voters have decided to give him a pass, I therefore will, like, it's my job to defend this is his also, deep awfulness.
This is a weird subvariant of the defenses of federalism that you sometimes hear. Like, it's, you know, well, if it happened at the local level, the tyranny is fine, right? Like, and this is something that I think reasonable libertarians can disagree, bingo, but I find myself increasingly unsympathetic to those arguments precisely because they seem to so often be used to justify clearly bad outcomes that are reducing individual freedom, and I think that's the case here as well.
But I think in this case, it's that if, you know, the stuff that's come out about Trump so far, if what Mueller reports, that it doesn't have anything to do with him in the White House or even in his campaign, people are going to be like, I don't care about crooked investment deals in New
York.
But
I think the Lowry insight is it doesn't matter at all. Like, anything could be in that report and it's very unlikely to matter. That's what Lowry is saying. And he's right. He's just wrong about whether we should go all in on a challenger, and by he means National Review conservatives, which is not.
He's struggling with the fact that you know National Review came out with a very strong early against Trump issue, where they absolutely said we're not trucking with this guy, and they are all like eating out of his hand right now, rich more than
and
anybody.
They've abdicated and that territory to the Bulwark, which is doing its own thing all in right now.
Well, there are anti-Trump writers. They have allowed some very strongly anti-Trump voices to be published there, and some of those folks, in fact,
absolutely,
are some of their most well-read writers. David French has not exactly been a friend to Donald Trump. Neither has Kevin Williamson or
They're not against Trump,
and
though,
yet,
for sure. They are not against Trump.
They've certainly backed away
don't
from
pretend
their cover.
They are absolutely not against Trump. They have walked back basically everything in their big issue, which I thought was a coherent and somewhat forward-looking statement. Matt, I would say that the question about the 2020 election that is worth asking is, you know, and without knowing who the Democrat is and how they go through the primary process, I do think if it's somebody who is serious, like a serious candidate who has no fun in his life and is very ideological, like Bernie Sanders, stands the best case not only for challenging Trump, even though his ideas are way outside of the political mainstream and make him virtually unelectable, but also to have the conversation that we were talking about, what is the proper size, scope, and spending rate of government in American life? Because one of the problems, and this goes back to what both Peter and Catherine were saying, is that, you know, the invocation of socialism, both by some Democrats as well as the use of it as an all-purpose pejorative by many libertarians, but certainly most Republicans, it really muddies the conversation that we need to be having. And this is where, when I talk to people at CPAC, they were like, well, you know, Trump is getting spending under control and the tax cuts were great. And when I said, well, what about, you know, like trillion-dollar deficits? And they're like, they either deny that it exists, which is troubling, or they say it doesn't matter, which is in keeping with, you know, the Republican Party line, at least since Dick Cheney early in the Bush years said that Reagan proved deficits don't matter. We need to have a conversation about, you know, because we're not debating socialism versus capitalism. We're debating, you know, the relative size and scope of government. And it'll be easier to have that, I think, actually, if Trump is against somebody like Bernie Sanders, as opposed to a newcomer, where a lot of the campaign coverage and conversation will be about finding out who this person is. And, you know, it won't actually be about issues.
Before we leave the topic of CPAC, Nick, since you were there and the rest of us weren't, you know, someone with the last name of Paul won the straw poll for about a half decade running every year there. Yeah. I was filled with young activists. There's a lot of Stand with Rand things, shirts visible back in the day, a lot of criminal justice content and booths and things like that, of which there was, again, this time around with Van Jones. Can you quickly characterize the libertarian leaning content of CPAC according to your eyeballs?
It was criminal justice, certainly, in having Van Jones there to speak with Matt Schlapp, the head of CPAC, and who they kept showing promotional reels of Matt Schlapp basically getting his ass handed to him by Chris Cuomo on CNN. But then at the end, it would say, get Schlapped, which was really just kind of fantastic in keeping with the Philip K. Dickian sensibility of this whole event. But
can we just interrupt? Sorry. Can we get nicked? Get nicked.
It sounds like we're doing a bad job shaving. Yeah. Like
get wet mangoed. Yeah. You know, it's like no, but it was nope. Mango you. No, mango you.
Big no.
But it was very Michelle Malkin. Michelle Malkin had the great, she gave one of the best speeches there because she attacked, like, first off, she spent like the first half attacking CPAC for having Van Jones because he's a socialist and a former community organizer. And she didn't even have mentioned that he, like, at various points was like questioning the 9/11 narrative and stuff like that. But she attacked him and then, and that they let people who actually have good things to say about immigrants there while keeping out, you know, good thinking Republican or conservatives. And she like name checked people like Gavin McInnes and whatnot. It was really kind of a great speech, but there was not a lot
of libertarian.
Didn't she
at one point like shake her fist at the ghost of John McCain?
She did. Yes.
That's how I start every day.
I mean, it, it's the only thing that gets me out of bed in the morning. But no, it was there was not a lot of libertarian stuff there, and certainly not compared to, you know, a decade ago or so. You know, when it was run by different people and it had it was more self-consciously trying to be a big tent and also to increase its audience every year. You know, having they did have Mike Pence and, you know, Donald Trump there. And I think it was the third year in a row, Schlapp said that they had both the vice president and the president. So they're doing, you know, they're doing well, but it's a very different kind of event. And it really kind of underscores the fact that in a highly polarized political moment, when you are going to win with under 50% of the vote, which is almost certainly the case for Donald Trump, you know, or it was in the previous election, probably will be again. You know, you're not being big tent. You're really, really, really speaking to your core audience. And the core audience are, you know, MAGA people and Trump tards. It's not, you know, you figure that certain people, you know, a lot of centrist people or a lot of libertarians or even a lot of conservative Democrats, if it's somebody like, you know, Bernie, they're going to vote for Trump or stay at home. But like you're trying to win, you know, with the score under 50.
Speaking of libertarian content, comma segue, over the weekend, Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky came out and said that he would vote against Donald Trump's declaration of a national emergency along the southern border. That is the tipping vote, decisive vote. Should and when that comes to vote in the Senate, it's already passed the House. A rebuke of the president's action here. He thus joins two or three other Republicans in the Senate, and then I think it was a total of a dozen House Republicans.
13.
Including Catherine's favorite Air Jordans wearing Congressman Justin Amash and Thomas Massie and a couple of others who joined in that opposition to a executive branch overreach. Catherine, are we living through the libertarian moment?
We were in the office on Thursday or Friday. We were suggesting that maybe we're living through the libertarian moment.
Oh, yes.
Like the libertarian moment is just like a fake scare story with like a lady with big eyes popping up in your videos sometimes, which.
Wait, I now know who I think is going to win 2020.
Momo.
What happened?
Yeah, it's going to be.
It's Momo, Sweet Merchant of Death, Sweet Meteor of Death. Like,
and John McAfee.
Oh, I might vote for that.
Yeah, that's troubling. Yeah, no, this is not the libertarian moment, but in some ways this is the payoff of the libertarian moment, right? Like what's left of the libertarian moment is that. Is like those 13 people.
This is like, the epilogue.
This is the epilogue. This is the coda. This is the final
the libertarian
movement.
Sneeze.
It's the libertarian sneeze. It's something. Those guys are like it's the libertarian remnant now, but they did good. That little posse.
They're libertarian Eeyores. They're just like, yeah,
we're gonna.
I guess you know, we'll I vote think against it. No
but
one.
But
listens.
It's more. It's actually you know, they're again, better than this Eeyores. Is where... They're better than Eeyore because they didn't have to. They could. The Eeyore wouldn't have shown up for the vote. But you know, they're somewhere in the Tigger.
Eeyore is diligent and responsible. He's just.
I would
sad.
Say they're in the Tigger space, though.
But
they're
here,
just like,
now, like think, boing! Think about think about this in a broader sense. Like I don't care who's president, and I don't care who owns Congress or has a majority in what House. What you want are particular outcomes, and this is a pretty good outcome. You know, where the president, and, you know, he'll never admit that he's getting kind of stuffed on this issue, but he'll change. He'll change his behavior. And I, you know, like, hopefully we can create an ecosystem where there's more of this stuff. People like Nancy Pelosi is actually, for many of her faults, she's actually kind of serious about fiscal rectitude. Much more so than most Democrats and certainly most Republicans. I mean, she was getting hammered when she was running for speaker by progressives in the Democratic caucus because she actually at least believes in the framework of PAYGO, of like any tax cut or spending increase has to come out of existing piles of money and stuff like that. And, you know, I think this
Nancy Pelosi, we need you're to, our only hope.
Yeah, no.
It's,
I mean,
totally
this
the
is
libertarian
like happened,
moment, guys. We've found it.
No, but what happened at the end of, you know, once Clinton, Bill Clinton, elected a Republican Congress. And again, you know, there are many bad things that happened in the 90s, but it also, the overall, you know, kind of gestalt or ecosystem ended up being pretty good. And I think, you know, that's what we should be trying to think about, like, what are the outcomes that help that along, or are we moving in that direction?
I actually just want to add a little bit in here to go back to Matt's question about whether this is 1972 and whether Richard Nixon Trump is going to run away with the election again because Democrats run too far left. I will just say, as an added point, I mentioned one of these conversations that I had recently with a moderate Democrat, but I have since heard several more moderate Democrats in private express great, great frustration with both Ocasio-Cortez and with Bernie Sanders, like a trepidation that Sanders might be the nominee. If you look at the polls, he's leading in certain ways. He has a pretty hardcore base of support. It's possible that he could end up basically being a kind of Trump-like candidate who just sort of keeps a good-sized base of support while all of the rest of the more mainstream contenders kind of duke it out. And so that you combine that with actually Nancy Pelosi consistently saying stuff about how the kind of the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, far left progressive agenda is kind of crazy. She doesn't use those words, but she talked about Medicare for All last week and was like, in some ways, is single payer is the simplest thing, but like you would have to move $30 trillion of spending onto the federal ledger, and how are you going to do that? Right? She just sort of dismissed the Green New Deal as Green Dream or whatever.
Dream.
I mean, right? And she actually, again, you know, she fought for PAYGO up front, you know, and I don't want to put Nancy Pelosi in the position of being like, oh, she's our hero, our savior. She is a left Democrat in many ways, but even she sees that the country isn't there yet. And if you actually look at support for Medicare for All amongst Democrats, the new bill that was released last week by Pramila Jayapal in the House actually has fewer supporters than the previous Medicare for All single payer bill in the House. The previous one had, I believe, 126, 127 co-sponsors, and this one only has 107 sponsors. And so you actually see some evidence that while progressives are getting a lot of attention and have a lot of enthusiasm, and there really is a lot of energy on the Democratic left at this point, it's less clear that there is commensurate public support amongst the general voting populace.
Yeah, just a point on that. In December, Gallup did asked Democrats and Republicans, did you want your party to become more liberal for Democrats or more conservative for Republicans, and a majority was something like 56 or 60% of Democrats said they wanted a more moderate party, whereas the same amount of Republicans said they wanted a more conservative party. So to your point, Peter, I think, it's always worth keeping in mind that the people who get the press are not necessarily the people who are representing where the party is going or what the members of the party want.
Of course, the having Rand Paul and the Senate go against Trump doesn't at all ensure that he won't veto. He won't use veto for the first time in his life, which calls to mind two questions, and I'll just throw them at Catherine, see what she thinks. That would be his first veto. Presidents stopped vetoing at some point. It was George W. Bush, I think, didn't veto at all in his first thing. It's very odd kind of a feature of our system now compared to even, you know, when Ronald Reagan was president, there's vetoes flying around. So interesting to figure out why that is. And then also just Does anyone think that there might be, besides someone unwrapping something live here on our podcast, Catherine, do you think that there's any chance that the number goes from 51 to 67 senators? A veto proof? Can we get the pendulum, the momentum? Can you make a mixed metaphor for me to describe what might happen among
Republicans? Will the number become left of the pale?
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's good.
Speak my language.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, this is one reason that presidents haven't vetoed very much lately is because they haven't had to, because Congress doesn't defy them very much lately. And also Congress just doesn't do much, period, lately. There is, you know, the dynamic, the adversarial dynamic between the executive and legislative branch has broken down, I think, to the detriment broadly of America. But I also think that there's, you know, this is sort of gets back to what we were talking about before. So much of American politics right now is oriented around checking the absolute worst excesses of a entitled executive. And you can look at that phenomenon and say, hey, maybe we're seeing a resurgence of checks and balances. Maybe we're seeing some people who are coming out of the woodwork and looking. And, you know, and there are, you know, there's always a new, you know, the Article One project and all these things that keep emerging and disappearing. That, I think, would be a misreading. That is not what is actually occurring. What is actually occurring is just like a mad scramble to do whatever appears possible in the moment to stave off the apocalypse every day. And there is no long-term thinking. There is no structural change occurring. If he vetoes and if they manage to muster 67, it will not be evidence of a resurgent legislative or of a rebalancing of the system. It will just be today's scramble.
But there's no chance that they're going to get to 67.
There's not.
Because, look, I
mean, unless the Watergate P-tape emerges, right, in which case the right politics of the whole thing,
yes,
changes.
It's
about
but in that
electoral
case,
politics.
You know, they nix this, but then it's really that becomes about impeachment. But no, I mean, I actually think it's interesting to think about whether this is interbranch competition or whether this is partisan competition. And it strikes me that it is partisan, that it is mostly partisan competition that is masquerading as interbranch competition.
Really? I mean, I want to hear your thesis, but I want to first throw out, like, the only place where there's any motion is the interbranch competition, because the parties have already, it's fully polarized.
So, hold on. It's not quite fully polarized.
The place
as
where Republicans
evidence
are moving, right, is in defense of.
So hold on. Let's look at this this resolution saying that, you know, against Trump's emergency declaration for the border wall. Trump's argument is not a constitutional argument. He has some lawyers who are basically saying, well, the emergency declaration thing allows me to basically do whatever I want because it's so vague. And Pelosi's argument is, again, not to like spend a whole podcast praising Pelosi, but Pelosi's argument is on the surface the correct one. What she argues is this is not about border security per se or about the border wall specifically. This is about maintaining the constitutional separation of powers in which only Congress has the power of the purse. And so every Democrat is going to vote for this, not because they want to preserve Congress's role, but because they want to check a Republican president who they really don't like. And you have a very small number of Republicans who actually are buying the constitutional argument, which is good and which is correct, but is not really what is driving this. And if you go back and you look at the Obama administration, the Obama administration got in a fight with Congress over the spending power. And it was related to Obamacare, where it's somewhat complicated, but basically there's a provision in Obamacare to pay it subsidies to insurers. These subsidies are called cost-sharing reduction subsidies. Insurers kind of have to give them to people below 250% of the poverty line anyway, but then the federal government is supposed to reimburse them under the law. However, it did not provide an actual authorization for that spending, an appropriation for that spending in the law. That was left up to Congress. The Obama administration asked for this money. Congress, the Republican Congress, said, nope, we are not giving you that money. The Obama administration spent that money anyway. Congress sued them, and a federal judge said Congress has the better argument. These payments are not correct. Stayed the decision. Obama administration kept paying anyway. But the point was that when it was the Obama administration doing this, Republicans were very clearly on the side of let's preserve the power of the purse for Congress. And now most Republicans are on the other side. You have Republican leadership in both houses saying we are trying to prevent defections against the president. It's just a partisan thing that happens to have a kind of a surface constitutional. This is a cake. The constitutional argument is the icing. But like the cake, which
that's
is
weird,
the,
though,
the
because...
main thing, which is like you can have a cake without icing. You can't have a cake without cake. Right. And like the cake here.
Say cake again. Say it a couple more times.
The cake is a lie.
Or is it a gay cake or a Nazi cake?
A partisan fight between Democrats and President Trump that some Republicans are signing on to. They are the little icing between the two.
Oh my God, stop with the icing. Yes. Okay. So I agree with you. I agree with you that the baseline of all of this is partisanship. Like that hasn't changed. That is where we live. That is where we have lived for many, many, many years, if not many administrations. But I think the movement, like the rate of change, like the thing that might be shifting, is about at least partially, or there's a desire to see it at least partially about reassertion of you know, the power of the legislature. In fact, well, the court.
How long does that last? I mean, does that last through the Kamala Harris presidency?
Yeah. No. What it does is what I mean, the real takeaway, I think, from, you know, a reason perspective is that you've got 13 people in the House and at least four Republican senators, probably more. Lamar Alexander has indicated that he's going to vote against Trump in the Senate as well, but that are actually voting against their party and against political pressure. And it's based on principle. They're not voting on this to get Trump or out of partisan reasons. And like, you know, this is, you know, it's a small culture.
It's a
seedling. Yeah, I agree. But, you know, you got to start somewhere. It's a, you know, we have to take these people and plant them somewhere where they can bloom and multiply.
Also, most people judge the goodness of a cake by how nice the icing looks.
Yeah. The icing is the worst part of a cake.
I think you just said the Constitution is bad.
I thought Suderman,
we
that
like
you were against
we're pro icing
no,
in this metaphor.
Not metaphorically.
Wait, what
in the metaphor, the icing is good. In real life, icing is not.
I am
good.
Going to force you to bake a cake for my gay wedding, and then we'll talk.
Catherine, speaking of gay weddings, let's go to our near end of show, not quite end of show, lightning round 2020 presidential campaign exertions. You want to talk about Kamala Harris.
Kamala.
Why?
Like the punctuation. Kamala. So she this week brought back the Equal Rights Amendment just for funsies, which is like more election signaling shenanigans. This is Elizabeth Nolan Brown did a quick write-up of this, but the idea that that this is going to be part of the American political conversation leading into 2020 strikes me as rather unlikely, but as a just bald-faced symbolic move, which is what the ERA always was. It's always been symbolic. There is not, in fact, a need for an amendment to say that the Constitution applies to ladies, I think it just shows the level that a lot of this election is going to operate on, which is massive proposal, not broadly speaking achievable, put forward to symbolically signal to voters what kind of person the candidate is.
So it's like the wall.
Just like the wall, except for the ERA at least wouldn't cost any money.
Speaking of feminism, Nick, what do you want to tell us about Joe Biden?
Biden is supposedly inching closer and closer to announcing. And my prediction with Biden is that if he gets into the race, that he is going to be kneecapped within 15 minutes because there's going to be suddenly a flood of all of the stuff that he did, particularly in 1988, where he plagiarized his biographical speech from a labor member of parliament in Britain, whose father was a coal miner, whereas Vinegar Joe's was not. And I think people are thinking he's formidable because he did have a good vice presidency and he's got a lot of name recognition, but he's really old. And he, almost as much as Hillary Clinton, represents the end of the old party. It's not, or the, you know, the kind of centrist establishment party, and I think everything will kind of congeal to just like spit him out of the race almost immediately.
Speaking of which, Andrew Cuomo, the governor of the state that I reside, is there was a big piece in The Atlantic a couple of days ago saying it all depends on whether Biden runs. And if Biden doesn't run, then here comes Cuomo, that Cuomo groundswell that we were feeling in Iowa. Rippling nationwide is going to come out. And I could just only say that as, again, if someone who has to suffer through local and state politics, which are always intertwined because the progressive era governance structure of New York and New Jersey and all these terrible states around here that Nick is from is just awful. It's god awful. You can't do a subway tunnel without the mayor and the governor arguing with one another. So my proposal for both of them, since Bill de Blasio was also thinking about running, talking about a national groundswell here, is for them to both go to Iowa, get into like a mud pit and get a bunch of bear grease and just wrestle each other constantly and stay the hell away from New York for the rest of both of their respective
terms. Is there
terms.
Specific to bears grease?
It's just
I'm thinking you want to go with olive oil, man.
After you shoot the bear, cold you render out the grease, you know? Man.
Thank you, Catherine, for being having at least some literacy here. Peter, you wanted to be at Bernie's launch in Brooklyn this weekend. Is that correct?
I was not there, and I can't say that I missed it too much, but it was at least parts of it were carried on cable news. The 2020 thing that I noticed was the Bernie's campaign launch. For his first big rally in which he held in Brooklyn on Saturday. And in some ways, the news there is that there was no news. Bernie Sanders is running on exactly the same platform that he has pretty much always run on. He is running on all the free stuff for everyone. If there is news, it is that he's launching his campaign, that he's holding his first rally, and it was a big rally, 13,000 people, in Brooklyn rather than in, say, Iowa or in Vermont, his home state, and really kind of signaling two things, I think. One is that he wants to kind of be a serious contender and a real front runner in the 2020 race, and two, that like Brooklyn is now the home for democratic socialism in America. And like that is where the core support, the energy is for a Sanders style campaign. It's really it's kind of an interesting moment in democratic politics to see that happen.
I'll also add that there was a recent what was the position here, Nick? Like the public advocate election here right. in New York City, and one of the people running was someone I'm friendly with named Nomiki Konst, who was just lost badly, and was running on as a public advocate a $30 minimum wage. So the beating heart of democratic socialism might not be electorally viable even in the city of New York, but it's alive and well in the presidential campaign. All right, let's go to our end of show. What the hell y'all been consuming stuff. Catherine, why don't you start since I think it's going to be weird.
It's the same answer it always is, but even better this week, which is rockets every week.
You can't consume a rocket.
I did, and I will fight you. This weekend was the long-awaited SpaceX launch with the Dragon capsule, which the launch went off flawlessly. The capsule was able to connect with the International Space Station without using the grappling arm, which they had previously relied on. That, by the way, is Canada's contribution to the International Space Station, the Canadarm, which if you ever ask a Canadian, what is Canada even good for? It's the third thing they will say after something having to do with hockey, probably, and Alanis Morissette. So
they're not going to say Alanis. They're going to say the comedian you didn't realize was Canadian.
Who?
Well, there's lots of them.
Oh, I see. There are lots of Canadian comedians.
And there's Drake.
Okay. Anyway, all this is by way of saying huge success for SpaceX, huge success for the private space industry generally, huge success for Elon Musk, who, let's be real, needed a win. given that he's also going to like SEC jail in a hot minute because he cannot stop tweeting, even though it's like
so relatable.
Literally illegal for him to tweet right now.
So relatable.
The piece of this that I always find interesting is like the NASA administrator who, you know, comes out and gives his statement, which is like, this is a great victory for America and the great American space program, which is all down to America. And, you know, in fact, I've got the quote right here. Today's successful launch marks a new chapter in American excellence. Once again, flying American astronauts on American rockets from American soil. And, you know, I think that's how NASA sees this. That's how NASA sees what happened here. And that's how a lot of Americans see it, that this was America had fallen behind in the space race and now we're good again. I really think that's the wrong way to see it. I really think this is, if anything, a repudiation of the NASA way of doing business and a success for free markets. Also, it was awesome. It was at 2 a.m., so I didn't get up to watch it in real time, and I sort of regret it.
And also, hashtag thanks Obama.
And thanks Catherine. Obama. That is correct. Obama, in an uncharacteristic move of certainly today's Democrats, I think it's very unlikely that any of the 2020 Democrats would do what Obama did, which is that he fought House Republicans who wanted to stick up for their district pork in the old school space industrial complex and actually managed to pass and allocate money for the commercial crew program, which is what yielded this result.
For those listeners who really enjoy deep cuts, I recommend trying to look on YouTube for a video of me arguing with Lou Dobbs about Obama's space program on Red Eye from a couple of years ago. Ooh. It is
Lou was against it. I mean, Lou went, he left CNN to go to space.com.
That's the thing. I started off with the because it was some dumb story about like a pop star wants to go to Mars or whatever. And
oh, it would have been Lance Bass probably.
And I started the thing with a very unsubtle dig to the ribs. I'm like, well, we're just fortunate that we have space.com founder Lou Dobbs on this panel. And as he's well aware, blah, blah, blah. But he was really upset because I gave Obama credit for anything, because obviously Obama's a socialist or something. And I pointed out that, hey, you know what? Free market is good in space. And he blew up at me and said, that's the problem with libertarians. It was great. They don't know what they're talking about. it's really the colors of his face. It was an entire rainbow of mud.
Do you get the idea that Lou like went to the dark side of the moon and then like his negative alter ego or something killed him and then came back to the planet?
That's
something like that.
I think there's
got to be something going on.
That sounds kind of autobiographical, Nick.
I am going next, and I'm just going to say that my next entrance here, which relates to Catherine's, might be exploring that in their next record release. So there's a new release by the Claypool Lennon Delirium, which is...
that's not real.
Sure. It's a semi-super group, although I think it's only just two dudes, Sean Lennon and Les Claypool from Primus. And they do like psychedelic rock, and they came out with a new record a couple of weeks ago that includes, and Catherine will absolutely like this, even if she doesn't like the song, she'll like the video for it, a kind of a suite. It's called Blood and Rockets, Movement One, Saga of Jack Parsons. And it's an ode.
Oh, my God.
It is like super awesome. The animation for it is, it's like, you know, post Yellow Submarine kind of Monty Python, tour through Jack Parsons, who, as we all know, was a crazy rocketeer, co-founder of JPL and Caltech, I think, too. And he dabbled with Aleister Crowley and probable sex cults. And it's just all terrific. The video, the song, it's great. Nick, what do you think?
Matt, what's your favorite Primus album? I need to know before we pass here.
I don't have a favorite Primus album. I haven't listened to a Primus album all the way through.
That sounds great. I'm going to be listening to that instead of... I've been trying to broaden and sophisticateize my musical palette. So I've been listening to a bunch of Miles Davis stuff because, you know, as I get older, I'm told that jazz is the thinking man's rock and roll. And, you know, I started with Bitches Brew, which was a big mistake, and it's just terrible. And then I've been working my way back, and even Kind of Blue, which is generally regarded as his, you know, ultimate masterpiece. I'm just not feeling it. I don't understand the appeal of jazz. It is to me just kind of wretched and boring. So that's a personal failing. So
I will save until a future podcast of my favorite moments of being a jazz splained by a common Flemish. Suderman, what have you been?
I'm hoping that soon I can consume an entire podcast of explaining why Nick is wrong about jazz. But in the meantime,
I'm more than willing to grant that I'm wrong. I'm simply saying I'm trying.
Not just consume, but be part of. Okay. Perhaps orchestrate, perhaps entirely monologue.
I want to be on the podcast and say nothing the whole time. I want it to be like, welcome to the Reason Editors podcast. And then I want to sit here silently while you douchebags fight it out over whether jazz is the thinking man's rock and roll for an hour.
I probably listened to like 4 hours of Miles Davis last night.
At the end, I just want to say, like, you know what's cool? Videos of babies getting cochlear implants, and that'll be it. That'll be my whole contribution.
Or cheese slices on their face. Go ahead, Suderman.
I watched the
Don't joke about that.
Of the new Netflix series, The Umbrella Academy, which is a sort of twisted superhero series based on a Dark Horse comic book. About a family of quasi superheroes, all of whom were sort of part of this weird wave of insta births, and then got adopted by a crazy scientist who also built a robot wife and then raised them to be superheroes. But because they're a family, they all came out kind of messed up and dysfunctional. And then the dad dies, and also there is a vision of the future had by one of the heroes who can both travel, who can sort of teleport in time, both in terms of location and in time, that sets off a chain of events that kicks off the rest of the show. It's really good. It's kind of stylish and interesting. I'm actually sort of like, it seems like they're developing some of the superhero themes that we've seen in comic books for years, but that we haven't seen quite so much in big screen, sort of more conventional feature length adaptations, where superheroes, you watch a Marvel movie or a movie about a Batman or Superman, and like fundamentally those movies are about how superheroes like have their shit together and are good. Even the darkest Batman stories are like, no, this is a person who has dedicated his life to a great cause. And in the comic books, I mean, really for a couple of decades now, creators have been starting to explore the idea that actually, if you were a superhero, you would be pretty messed up, and that would be a hard thing to be, and it would kind of derange you for the rest of your life, even if you were a basically good person.
I will take moderator's privilege here and add an addendum to the cultural stuff, which is to say, if you really want to make yourself sad for a long time, here on Monday, watch part two of the Finding Neverland documentary on HBO, which is just it's terrible. It is it'll make you really sad about Michael Jackson and the world. I know some people like to get even sadder than they are. That's all the sadness we have time for on today's Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason podcast. Thank you for listening. Please write comments and reviews and all those kinds of things. And stay tuned for more great Reason podcasty content the rest of the week. Bye.